Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Stillman. How you
Hey,
doing?
Dave, I'm doing radiant. I feel great today. Life is good.
Oh man, me too. I'm just happy. I'm drinking water, chewing gum. I haven't had breakfast, so my breakfast this morning is water and gum.
You know, Dave, in the week since our last podcast, we've gotten hundreds of emails about our last guest. Probably the most popular guy we've ever had on the podcast. We thought we'd bring him back again. Matt Howard, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Yeah, I'm flabbergasted at the response. Just the internet's blowing up with Matt Howard. So we really want to get into what makes Matt Howard tick this week.
Yeah, I'm not really surprised by the response. I think it's really what your show's been waiting for. It was nice to finally get some good tunes on there.
Yeah, I think that was part of it, yeah. The jewel of Cedar City, they've been calling you on the web. I don't know if you knew that.
They've been calling me that for years, Steele.
Yeah. So, Matt, the thing that we thought we'd start off today is expert testimony, where we ask our guests to just talk about things they know a lot about. We've got a special segment of To the Limits. We've got Ask Off the Chain with some of the many questions that people have directed, especially towards Matt. And then we've got Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. So there's a lot to cover and not a lot of time. Let's get started. Started off, I wanted to ask you, Matt, the thing that I knew you for most when we lived together was your extraordinary library of self-help books.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know anyone who had quite as many titles and who really delved deep. Could you explain a little bit about like what drew you to the genre and really what kept you there?
Well, still, I don't know if you remember, but when you met me, I think I was working in the daytime as a janitor. That's right. Professional janitor, too.
Yeah.
Not like as a side job.
I mean, wasn't an amateur. This was the career.
No. And in the nights, I kept myself busy working at a gas station. And if there's any recipe that's going to lead you towards self-help books, that's it. So, yeah, self-help books. The funny thing is I definitely enjoy buying them more than reading them.
Well, I mean, you're a collector. You're a collector more than a connoisseur.
I get a real kick out of the titles. They're wonderful. And among probably the most influential were the ones that got me doing enemas for a while.
Tell me about that, because that was another thing that you were legendary about. I mean, keeping a clean colon. That was something everybody knew Matt Howard was all about.
Yeah, well, and they should, because colon health is important. There's really not enough advocates out there, bringing the concerns, to the public of how clean a colon needs to be. So, yeah, I just did colon, cleanses there for a while. There's not really a whole lot to say about it other than there's definitely some strategy, some technique needed to do it correctly, but it gives you an amazing feeling. And
but how long does it last? How long does that amazing feeling last?
There's an initial like, whoa, wow. And then you just have kind of this emptiness, which isn't a bad emptiness, not a negative emptiness, but an emptiness of like
lightness of being.
A lightness, thank you, Steele, that lasts at least a couple of hours.
Huh.
So you eat your next hamburger.
Do you think it's like a drug use? For instance, the first time you use cocaine, it's fantastic, but then you just have to keep going back, using more and more to get the feeling that you had originally?
At one point, I was probably doing, 20 to 30 a day. No, of course not.
Are enemas the amphetamines of colon health? That's Dave's question. Breaking news.
There's a great, great support group, though, for people who struggle from enema addiction.
But genuinely, were there other self-help books that like were actually helpful to you, that you enacted principles in your life that you felt it was beneficial?
In seriousness, the Arbinger Institute has come out with some books that have been really good. And they just actually did a second edition of one of their books that I have not got yet. I think it's The Anatomy of Peace. It's the second book they published. And they just did a second edition, which supposedly has a bunch of great new stuff in it. But I'm really a fan of the Arbinger Institute's work.
Arbinger,
Arbinger.
That's great.
I've been a lifelong student of theirs.
Nice. You know, Matt, I've been wanting to ask you about this for years, actually, because you had a book. I believe it was yours. It was in the house, at least. And I read it, and Mark Ellison studied it, and it changed our lives. It was a book about, like, sexual attraction and attracting mates. And one of the pieces of advice it has was, like, you go into a door frame when you enter a room, you lean against the wall, you try to make eye contact for uncomfortably long amounts of time, and then they suggested that you take your thumbs, you hook them into the belt buckle, and you make a little triangle, so like facing your crotch, and just stand there then, because it draws attention to your groin. And man, we used to do this all the time, and I tell you what, it worked wonders. So I just wanted to thank you. And if you remembered the title, I'd love to share it with our listeners.
You know, the title of that one escapes me right now, Steele. I'm a little more distracted by thinking about what other adventures you and Mark had with each other while reading that book.
Oh man, I can't tell you all the things we tried for the first time.
Although I will tell you, when Dan Chinatown stood up in church one day and started talking about his friend that's into all this self-help mumbo-jumbo books.
Did it touch you that he called you a friend? Was that really touching a moment?
And he started talking about him, and I was like, yeah, Dan. And I was happy because I was, you know, I was like, the ward's going to know that I'm into self-help books. And, you know, that's like really the reason most people, at least myself, that's why I buy them, so that people can see them on my shelf and know that.
He's improving himself. This guy's working.
But then he made the great reveal, and I was pretty ticked off that his friend was Mark Ellison. So you need to get that guy on the show if you want to really find out about the triangle crotch of power and all that stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't get enough. That the author was a genius.
I think we can all thank that author for our marriages at this point.
He might have been the one that wrote the same about men with hollow chests. Not the C.S. Lewis essay, but a guy who wrote a book on a similar topic of not having a hollow chest. And Tyler Kobe would always walk around smashing us in the chest saying, "Don't be a hollow chest." And that was from another one of my books.
Man, you were helping everybody out, really. I think of it as like a lending library of mutual improvement is really what it was.
And is this something that continues, Howard? I guess you're still reading Arbinger. Are you picking up other little gems at the local thrift store?
Yeah, I do regularly. I just bought one. I don't know if you'd call it self-help, but How to Be Funny.
A lot of people learn that from a book, I would say, How to Be Funny. Yeah. It's definitely a book skill.
That was just a couple weeks ago, and I still buy multiple copies of books and give them to people, and I have not had very good success of people receiving them well.
Hey, well, I'll give you my mailing address. I would love to receive any self-help book that you think would be worth sending me.
I gave one to a guy, and he gave it back to me about 2 months later, and he's like the nicest guy you'll ever meet in your life. And he said, "I skimmed the front and back cover."
Wow.
I think that's the response you're going to get when you give someone a self-help book, Matt. I think you just got to accept that.
I think with self-help books, I think what's really going on is everyone that buys them, at least myself, buys them because secretly they want to write one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's what's
sure.
coming next, guys.
What, do you have a title yet for yours, or
Unleash the Beast?
Enema's the easy way. I don't know what the title's going to be, but it might have something to do with being bald. I don't know. Mm.
We could crowdsource that. We could ask our listeners, if you have any ideas for Matt Howard's next self-help book, please send them in. He will consider it. We'll have a little contest out of it, and maybe we'll get something that's worth running with, Matt.
I think it's practically written now that you've said that, Steele. Thank you.
Our thousands of listeners. Well, Matt, the next thing I want to ask you about, I know that you're a big expert in, are adolescent teens. So,
yes, I am an expert on adolescent teens. Specifically, 14-year-old boys. I really like 14-year-old boys.
How did you come by
this?
Yeah,
what? How'd this happen, Matt?
I believe what you're referring to is that for about 3 years I worked as a supervisor manager of a boys' ranch down in southern Arizona, and we had a lot of teenage boys there. And I spent 2 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, working with the teenagers on this ranch and the staff that were teaching them and all that stuff. So it's funny, one of those things. I wouldn't consider myself an expert on it, but I think a lot of other people would.
Oh, yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Sure. And Matt, I heard you, this is an earnest question, but I heard you tell a story that was really quite a moving story about your experience there and some things that you learned. And I feel like probably adolescent male teenagers are maybe one of the most misunderstood groups in our society. What would you say is, from your experience, one of the biggest misunderstandings we have about teenage boys?
I think teenage boys are like, they're like adults, except they actually want to know that what's really going on. Like they have like this sincere interest and care in the world. They're like adults, but they're unafraid of stuff.
Huh.
They're like adults that haven't given up yet.
Sure.
Haven't settled yet. And that's a really hard place to be in when you're 14, 15 years old, because you've got all these desires and things that you want to do and places you want to, ways that, you know, truth, like just that greater idea of truth is such an important idea. And I feel like it's no time is it more important than when you're like a 14, 15 year old boy trying to figure out the world, what's going on. And when you see like you're in these situations with parents or teachers or other kids that aren't truthful, but you don't have the maturity to figure out how to balance that. And it can be really, really hard. But I feel like a lot of the misunderstanding about these teenage boys is because they're seeking for this truth. They're trying to figure out how to incorporate it into their lives and to align their lives with what is true. Mm. And they just, it's hard to do. It's really hard to do. But they're really trying. And it's that trying that gets ugly.
I was going to say, Matt, I was thinking about myself as a teenager. And I think I was very much a big time dreamer, like an enormous idealist. But I also had like a wholly unrealistic expectation of like what integrity meant or what like living according to your insane principles meant. And like, I was almost a fanatic about like, if it doesn't match with these principles, I'm just going to reject it. And they're phonies or they're sellouts or whatever word I would have used at the time. And that was really hard, that feeling of like being disillusioned by the adult world and thinking that I somehow had it more figured out, but knowing deep down that I didn't, you know, it was a weird mix.
So Howard, are there lessons from this experience that you want to apply to your life as your boys get older, become teenagers? Are there things that you feel are important?
Yeah, I've got three boys, and I've got a 7-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And it almost sounds trite, but after, you know, 3 years at a boys' ranch, 2 years at a wilderness therapy program, and even currently I work in the mental health profession. We serve teenagers. I'm in a different capacity. I don't work directly with them. But compassion and generosity.
Hmm.
I mean, just really accepting my boys where they are, being compassionate and being generous to them.
You're saying about how you treat them, or is this something that you want them to develop and show towards others, or both, I guess?
No, more I would like to be able to do it myself. I'm not too concerned with trying to like teach them stuff or make them do things or have them behave in certain ways, because I'm confident that if I can govern myself and get myself to do things correctly, that they'll be just fine.
Hmm. But it's showing a compassionate generosity towards your boys that you think is important.
Yeah. Sorry, man. That's not very specific. Actually doing dangerous things, I think, is really important. That's something we did at the boys' ranch. It was a legitimate ranch experience. They did dangerous things. They rode really very dangerous animals. They welded. They did work projects with like real tools that where they could really get hurt. And sometimes they did. And I think that doing dangerous stuff is very important.
I worked in one of these places actually with you, the wilderness program, and I loved working there. One of the things that I felt was important for the kids was, yeah, to do things that were hard. They were, you know, starting fires with sticks, caring for themselves out in the desert for 6 weeks, and just kind of being able to see that they could do really difficult things. I think it changed their perspective on who they were.
I can't tell you how many students we would have come to the boys' ranch who had never worked. It's a very common thing, I think, especially among children that grow up in suburbs, cities, which is the vast majority of children, I think, that they've never dug a trench. They've never – some have even never washed dishes. They've never just done hard things. Forget like – you know, I think a lot of that stuff, that the hard work is now funneled towards kids do sports.
Mm-hmm.
Or they do some other outside activities. I don't know what they're doing, but they're not doing work. At least not the ones that end up at boys' ranches.
I feel like there's a gap in my experience. So I've had several jobs, and I've worked a lot with younger children, and then I've worked with college students. But I don't feel like I have as much experience spending a lot of time with adolescents or with... Did you feel like it was important, Matt, for you to... Like, what aspect of your persona did you have to inhabit most in dealing with them? Like, I know with kids, it's just really easy to be fun and outgoing and dorky or whatever, and kids, little kids love that. But how did you choose to interact with teenage boys?
Man, Steele, that's a great question. And here's what I think about that. Every kid in these programs knows the game. And the game is tick off the leaders.
Right.
Push their buttons, get the responsible adults, the supervisors, whatever, get them to be frustrated with you, get them to be angry with you, and then you've got all the justification you need to do whatever you want.
Yeah, sure.
They know that's the game, but the staff, most of the staff working there, they don't know that's the game. They don't get it. Huh. It's just this weird thing that, you know, you hire a 24-year-old kid or even a 21-year-old boy who, you know, 7 years ago was a teenager, and he forgets that whole thing. He forgets that whole idea. And so for me, the kind of the way that I would have to interact with these is, one, first is having a profound respect for the students there, because I believe that like if I have a profound, like a deep respect in them and a deep, really sincere belief that they are just doing the best they can like the rest of us, that there's really very little difference between us other than our age and amount of hair that we have.
So you're confirming that you are bald, Matt? Is that, that's correct?
Yeah, it's in. And then just never forgetting the game, man. Like, this is not about me. This is not about, you know, you making me mad. Like, this is not about that. This is right. about bigger, more important truths and growth and togetherness. So
does that resemble or is that different from working in the mental health profession that you're working in now?
Well, it's a lot different. I mean, well, it's tremendously different. Right now I work for a psychiatric hospital. It's a short-term stay hospital.
Uh-huh.
So we get people that are literally at the end. 70% probably of our patients have recently attempted or very seriously considering suicide. Another part are, you know, serious drug, you know, have some very serious drug problems or just flat out psychosis. So we get them at the end. They only stay with us for about a week. It's very focused on pharmaceuticals and therapy is a part of it, but there's only so much you can do in a week's time. Whereas at the Boys Ranch, it was 10 months. It's not that the students are any different. It's just that there's a lot more time and space. So here's the thing, man. I can put on a show for a week, but I can't put on a show for 10 months.
Right.
So that's kind of the difference. They're just different approaches that help people at different encountering different problems.
Yes, and because the wilderness program we both worked at was pretty short term. It was awesome to be able to spend a week with a kid that wanted you to hate them and do, you know, was doing all sorts of crazy behaviors to make you really angry. And it wasn't hard to keep to love that kid for a week. I could love a kid for a week, no matter what he's doing. I could do it, except there was probably a couple I couldn't. But it wasn't hard to keep that up. And it was a really good experience to love this kid that's really having a tough time. And usually the kid would recognize that and accept it and be a really positive thing. But it was only for a week. Hmm. That's all.
I was thinking about this as a parenting thing, and I don't know. I think we've talked about this briefly, Matt, but I know there's some cultures or some states where there's, you know, an endemic of suicidal teens, and a lot of them, like, for example, teens that experience same-sex attraction in some parts of the country are mm-hmm. much higher risk of homelessness or suicidal thoughts. And it seems to me connected to, like, the way that this is a fundamental part of their identity, but for sometimes parents or other people in their life, they're saying, I can't accept this part of you. And it's not just a game you're playing for a week or a game you're playing for a few months, but some part of you that is going to be you, has been you and will be you for years and years. I mean, I think that would be such a destructive feeling to have as the young person feeling that, like, from a parent or an adult in my society.
You know, the only thing I can say about that is it's true. I mean, I'm here in Utah, which is, yeah, just like you said. And that response that parents or adults have toward teenagers, I think it has a lot to do with people that are unwilling to or have yet to face their own shadows.
Really?
To look into their own, the parts of themselves that they, because we all have parts about ourselves that we don't like, that we're ashamed of. And if we never face those, if we never look at our own, then we can't handle it when other people have them, especially if those other people are our own kids, which in turn reflects back on us. Which might even make our own. So I think that's a consequence of us, a culture or society where that's unwilling to look at our own shadows in a real way.
Yeah, that's pretty profound. I don't know if I have any more questions right now about adolescent teens or the psychological stuff, but anything you wanted to ask, Dave?
Yeah, I think that we need to get to something a little more important than love and, you know, mental health. Because if there's one thing I know about Matt Howard, is that he loves a particular rock band. If you could define them as a rock band, I wouldn't want to just pigeonhole them into one genre of music. unless it would, I could pigeonhole them into just flute rock, is, I guess, is what they would be, flute rock. So, Matt, Jethro Tull, that is that still your favorite band of all time?
Absolutely. To the day I die.
So, I have a bunch of questions here. I think we're just going to kind of go rapid fire here.
Yeah. Okay.
Just kind of work through them. So, Jethro Tull, they won an Emmy? Is that possible?
I think it was a Grammy. Yeah, they
a Grammy.
An Emmy for daytime television.
and they beat out Metallica. It's a great story. You know, you should.
Wait, they competed against Metallica for a Grammy? What category were they competing in?
Oh, you know, I don't remember the exact one, but it was like heavy metal performance or something like that. And it was the first year that they had awarded that. And it went to Jethro Tull on their Crest of a Knave album, which is super heavy, man.
And I don't know if you remember this, but James Hetfield's concession speech said, "We just didn't have enough flute. Metallica's going to go back to the drawing board. We're going to add a little flute, and we're going to come back next year and win that Emmy."
When Metallica finally did win their Emmy, they thanked Jethro Tull for not writing an album that year.
Yeah.
Second question, should there ever be flute in a rock song?
I don't understand that question.
Good point. Look,
Ian Anderson started playing the flute because he couldn't play the guitar as well as his bandmate, and he didn't want to play second fiddle.
And we should just clarify this, right? So when you mentioned Ian Anderson, that is Jethro Tull's actual name. Is that right?
So
yeah, that's his real name?
Yeah.
Jethro Tull is, I think he invented some sort of farm equipment in the 1800s.
So he's been around for a long time making music.
Yeah, not a musician. No. Farm equipment inventor. And these three gentlemen that formed the band that was originally called Jethro Tull, they had such a hard time booking gigs when they started out that they would have to change their name every 2 or 3 weeks so they could get new places that would book them.
Because they're like, these guys showed up with the flute last time. Do not book under any circumstances this band.
And the name they hit it big on was Jethro Tull.
Nice.
So Jethro Tull and Ian Anderson are two different people.
One of them's a Highlander, apparently. He's been alive since the 1800s.
Still playing the flute. Are they still making music? Is this still happening?
Ian Anderson is still producing a lot of solo albums, yeah.
Okay.
So Jethro Tull, I think, is disbanded, but it's pretty easy for them to come back. All that has to happen is Ian Anderson has to decide, and they're on.
Boom. They're back in the tractor game, running. Though, Dave. You should see their newest tractor. It's amazing. It's really all the rage here in Wisconsin.
So can you explain to me the album Thick as a Brick? What's going on there?
I can't explain it. I just know that it was the first album I got as a CD, and it had two tracks on it. And that kind of blew my mind when I got it as a teenager. I was like, wait, only two songs? And it was just both sides of the original LP into two tracks. And it's something that doesn't really – if you need it explained, then it's a waste of time. It's not going
to – So it's something you just have to feel. You just have to feel it through music.
Like if I explained an enema to you, man, you just got to experience it, Dave.
That's great.
And I was on the internet and I saw that Ian Anderson produced a Thick as a Brick 2. Have you listened to this?
You know, I actually have. And like a lot of Jethro Tull music, it kind of sounds like a children's song at the beginning.
Yeah. Then it blows you away.
And then it blows you away when he whips out the flute and just... But I can't tell you a whole
lot. What does he do with it? He whips out the flute and does what?
The flute and just plays.
He just wails. I think he just wails.
My understanding, so I think Jethro Tull has this powerful iconography where there's this silhouette of a one-footed guy hopping around on a flute. Is it true that he plays his flute like that? And have you ever seen him do it?
Yes, he'll play like that for hours.
Wow. That's
you know, we all have to suffer for our art, and Ian Anderson does.
He's
you know,
a flamingo.
Yeah, a flute mingo.
Is that what he refers to himself as, the flute mingo?
That was what band was called when they couldn't get gigs. They had to change it to Jethro Tull. Do not book flute mingo again.
So, Howard, what's your favorite Tull? What's your number one Tull? Do you have one?
Well, it's Aqualung, without a doubt.
Yeah.
If only because it was what got me started on the band. It was the first one, and it really is one of the greatest albums.
And it's about an old pervert, so.
About an old pervert. The song's got a little twist, though, Steel, you know?
It hits home. So do you think that's their greatest accomplishment?
I would think so.
It's all...
I mean, unless you want to look at the, you know, the length of their, you know, they were 40.
You got to finish that sentence. Sorry.
The length of their touring and okay. music, you know, their discography, it's extensive.
Yeah, it seems like so if someone was going to just, you know, I want to get into flute rock, what would you tell them to pick up?
Aqualung. Hate to keep saying it, but it's the best. You know, I really like Stand Up and their other first album, which has much greater blues influence. But they're really a band that has probably a dozen different styles of music.
Last two questions. Does your wife have any idea what or who Jethro Tull is?
No.
And I'm going to keep it that way.
It's one of my greatest shames, man. Like, I just can't figure out how to get her to engage with any pop culture. You
know? We've all got shadows in our closet.
Her eyes just kind of glaze over. It's like...
So have you ever been able to convince someone, hey, you want to get in a Tull, and then they did it? Has that ever happened?
No.
That sounds like my mission experience.
The gospel of Tull is a difficult one to preach.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited because later in the podcast, we're going to do a very special Unchained Melodies, which may have something to do with what we've just been discussing.
Oh, it's going to be a treat. Well, thank you. Thanks, Matt. I'm sure our listeners will have hundreds of more questions. We want to do a quick segment here, though, now. It's called To the Limits. And in this segment, we discuss incredible feats of human endurance. Dave, you have one of the most remarkable stories that I have ever heard of.
Yeah. So this guy that goes by the name of the Iron Cowboy, he recently just completed doing 50 Ironman triathlons for 50 consecutive days in 50 different states. So he started in Hawaii, flew to Alaska, and then started going down the West Coast and kind of just spiraled through. You can look up to see his map to see what he did. But this guy is a really neat guy. I have a nephew with a cerebral palsy that in the past, this man has taken my nephew on a triathlon. My nephew's name is Dayton, and he's had a few people take him on different triathlons because he loves it. He loves the feel of just wind blowing into his face, and so he loves the swimming, the biking, and the running. So this man in the past has taken my nephew on one of these triathlons. So this time, when they came to Arizona, my nephew went up, and one of the Iron Cowboys, like, buddies biked with him and ran with him to keep alongside. My sister-in-law is pretty good friends with him, and she ran with him, and she didn't think Arizona one was like his seventh one. He looked terrible. He was almost walking to the finish line. She thought, there's no way that this guy is going to be able to do 43 more of these things. He just looked awful, but he just got it back together. He started getting IVs almost every day because he just couldn't replenish enough hydration or enough calories. Some of these things would take him. When he wasn't feeling well, it would take like 17 hours. And then you have to just get in the van, drive to the next one and go. When he performed well, he could do them in 11 or 12 hours so he could actually get some sleep. So he's sleep deprived, calorie deprived, dehydrated. And he's doing this all, you know, to challenge himself, to challenge the human limits, which is amazing. But he also was doing it to kind of raise awareness for childhood obesity. At the end of every marathon that he ran in his triathlon, the last five kilometers, he would have kids come out and run with him to help raise awareness for just being active.
Were they any kids, or did he screen them for just the chubby ones?
Yeah, only chubby ones. Just little, they'd call them his little piggies, he'd call them. Obviously, that's not true, but.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just ruined a really touching story, didn't I? No, that guy sounds incredible. And I really am glad he did it for a cause, because just to imagine somebody just doing that because seems kind of awful to me.
It's maybe a little, I don't know, a little egotistical even, just doing it to kind of celebrate yourself. And just, of course, you know, he's celebrating himself. He's doing an awesome thing. But he's doing it for a cause. Just an amazing summer. He's got five kids. He's like... He's in his 30s. He's in excellent shape, obviously, but they drove around all summer with their dad doing amazing triathlons.
That's awesome, Dave. So I'm going to talk about, for my story, The most extraordinary, the most difficult thing I've ever seen another human being do was give birth. And it was when my wife had our babysitter. And it was a long labor and pretty intense, regular pain for a big chunk of that. I have a sister that had a baby the last year that had like a 72-hour labor. Sister-in-law had a very long labor. And so I was thinking about childbirth as this ordinary, everyday, pretty extraordinary thing that women do all the time that I would never, ever want to do or volunteer for. And I decided to find out who is the woman who had the most children in history. And according to, I believe, the Guinness Book of World Records, this is an unnamed woman, which is so fitting, really. She was the wife of Fyodor Vasilyev, a peasant from Russia in the 18th century. She was pregnant 27 times, which you think, oh, that's no big deal. But in those 27 pregnancies, she had 16 sets of twins, seven what? Sets of triplets, and four sets of quadruplets. Every one of her births was a multiple, which means that she had a total of 69 children.
I can't believe that. That's insane. How many of these kids survived past childbirth? You have any idea?
I don't know. I didn't have that information. But just to think about this. To be pregnant 27 times means that you are pregnant for more than 20 years.
It's unbelievable. Just the number of children, they're peasants. How could they possibly have cared for these kids? Obviously, yeah, we've talked about that. I have a set of triplets here, just wonderful girls. There was no way my wife was doing a vaginal delivery of those girls. And this woman had to have done vaginal deliveries of all these children. It would have been really dangerous and hard on the children to be birthed that way. We did C-sections. And this woman just shot them out. It's amazing.
So, and just imagining if you have 27 births, you only have a certain number of years of fertility, which means that there are several times in their life in which they have one-year-old quadruplets and probably infant triplets with, you know, some two-year-old twins and some three-year-old twins and some four-year-old triplets and some five-year-old quadruplets and some six-year-old twins. Like, that just has to be how it is. It's incomprehensible to me.
But think of the workforce, Stillman. That's why they're doing this. Man, a minor city with these amount of children, they're producing a lot of farm goods.
Yeah, and I guess I made a mistake saying she was unnamed. Her name literally was Mother Russia. That's where it comes from. So that's my to the limits. Matt, you got something to contribute?
You know, I just looked up this thing real quick. And, you know, Dave, you've probably already heard about this guy, but Jack LaLanne, you guys familiar with him? The first fitness superhero?
Yeah, oh, I've heard of this guy. I saw him doing push-ups on Good Morning America once, I think, or towing a tugboat with his teeth.
Well,
he's way into juicing.
Colon health. It's the key. Yeah. It's the ingredient that binds them all together.
Well, once this guy put 70 rowboats, tied them all together, put people in those rowboats, and then pulled on them.
Did they go anywhere, or did you just pull on them?
He just kept tugging. Man, this is hard.
He hobbled himself, and he had handcuffs on, and he swam and pulled those tugboats across some bay somewhere. So there you go.
Jack LaLanne, a tied-up tugboat puller.
Afterwards, he juiced a lot of fruit. That they replenished him quickly. Jack LaLanne juicers are the best, man.
Tugboat pulling juicer. That's not a nickname you want to have.
With your 50 triathlons, guy, it just makes you wonder at what point would the human body give up?
I mean, mine would have given up probably halfway through the first. That's where my human body would have given up.
500? What do you do? Because prior to the 50 consecutive, what was the highest anybody had ever done?
Before that, he had the record for most done in a year, and it was like 30. So that was not consecutive. So I don't know what the record was for most consecutive.
I'm thinking it's like five.
Yeah, it's a ludicrous jump that he's taken. And I don't know. It makes me feel bad. Yeah, I jump out and I go run 2 miles and I feel really winded. Like, oh, geez, that was a rough run.
You know what it makes me? It makes me really hope that Puerto Rico never becomes a state, because this guy would be compelled to do it all over again. I have to add the 51st. You know, it'd be awful. Under no circumstances are we to let Puerto Rico become the 51st state.
Yeah, he's the number one antagonist. He's anti-Puerto Rico now. We can't let it become a state. It's ridiculous.
Destroy my accomplishment. All right, so that's To the Limits. We've got some extraordinary examples of human endurance. We have, as we said at the beginning of this episode, literally hundreds of questions that we've been weeding through to try to ask on this episode. I mean, the outpouring, the mailboxes are stuffed full. Keep them coming, people. If you have questions for us to answer on the air, we'll do it. We have a special segment of Ask Off the Chain today. Here's the first question I have for us. I need to get a part-time job to make some ends meet for the short term. What do you recommend? Any advice for this? I'm sorry, I didn't read the name. This was Omar H. from Pasadena.
Well, Omar, I would recommend getting a job teaching English as a second language, because you'll be in a room full of people that don't speak English.
So anything you say goes, huh?
Exactly.
You're the tyrant.
It's not that great, but neither are the expectations. So go for it, man. You can't lose, really.
Dave, any advice for Omar?
Oh, yeah. If you have a vehicle, pizza delivery, you're going to get tips. You charm the people. And if someone calls in a fake order, the pizza's messed up, who's going to eat it, Omar? It's going to be you. It's free pizza, man.
Nice. Great pro tips. Thanks, guys. Okay, next question. This is a question from someone who is outraged. This is absolute outrage. This is from Marion P. from the San Francisco area. Come on. Shouldn't Barry Bonds be in the Hall of Fame? I don't know why this question was directed to us, but let's handle it.
I think it depends on what Hall of Fame you're looking at. If you're looking at an increase in head size Hall of Fame, he's in. Like, I've never seen a head get bigger than his. Yeah, I vote for him right now. We could make that Hall of Fame right now. Guy that's head grew the biggest through steroid use, Barry Bonds, in. I'm in.
What about the people from Ringworld? What are they called, Dave? Their foreheads grow really big when they eat the Tree of Life? Maybe he's one of those. Maybe he's a pack protector.
He could be. He could be. That explains his home run power.
Yeah, and his tiny gonads.
Yeah, I believe they shrivel whenever you eat that stuff from Ringworld. Oh, jeez.
You got anything to add on the subject of tiny gonads, Matt?
It's been a while since I heard that word, Steelman. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I try to keep things literary here on the pod.
Truly.
Okay. Another question. This one's from George W. from Philadelphia. He says, who's your favorite baseball player of all time?
Oh, wow. That's exciting. I'm going to go back. I was a teenager in New Jersey when the Yankees were terrific. And a true Yankee is Paul O'Neill. If you weren't a Yankees fan, you probably hated Paul O'Neill. He was the type of guy to, like, throw the water cooler down. Yeah, he was the kind that if you hate him, if he's not on your team, but he's on your team, so he's just this guy with heart. And Paul O'Neill just had heart. And I still remember you'd make signs, take him to Yankees games. I still remember going to one Yankee game, and someone made a sign that wanted O'Neill to hit a homer run. And it said, oh me, oh my, O'Neill. And we made fun of that sign for like a decade.
It's got a lot of miles on that sign. You know, as far as I'm concerned, Paul O'Neill was dead to me when he left the Cincinnati Reds. So I have no idea what he did. I mean, did he even have a career with the Yankees?
Yeah. He's a true Yankee still. I'm surprised they haven't retired his number yet.
Matt Howard, you got a favorite baseball player?
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I don't. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Baseball is terrible. I'm glad you don't have a favorite player. Actually,
still,
I have a favorite.
Yeah, what's your answer?
Okay. This one's easy. It's the greatest baseball player of all time. Greatest leadoff hitter, greatest left fielder, greatest base stealer. Today, I am the greatest of all time. Ricky Henley Henderson. Born on December 25th on Christmas Day. He was my favorite. Loved him. The man of steel, in fact. So it's easy to see why he was my favorite.
Wonderful man. Wonderful speaker. Humble as well. Really down to earth.
He had probably the best sunglasses in the game. Also was well known for his snap catch, where he would just kind of leave his glove down by his hip till it was about to land, and then he would reach up real fast and just grab it out of the air till his manager made him stop doing for hot dogging.
If you're going to do something, do it with style.
That's what I always say. We got another baseball-related question. This one is from Lindsay P., who identified herself as the president of the One-Armed Americans Society. Lindsay P. said, Jim Abbott pitched a no-hitter with only one hand. Why don't you think about that, jerks? I didn't see the question mark there, but I don't know if you wanted to respond to Lindsay P.'s angry email.
Oh boy, Lindsay, I'm impressed with what Jim did. That's terrific. It reminds me of the last show we did, a Would You Rather. And at my hospital, I was asking Would You Rather questions last week. And one of them was, would you rather have be missing a hand right at the wrist or be missing a leg at the knee?
Hand. Well, I don't know. Actually, they have those prosthetics now. You can do everything with like a. Do I get a prosthetic or do I have no prosthetic?
Oh, yeah, you get a prosthetic, sure.
I don't know what the state of robot hands is like, but I think it's probably harder to duplicate the fingers and thumb movement than it would be to just duplicate a lower leg. So, boy, lower leg, I guess I'd choose.
Yeah.
You're no Jim Abbott.
Yeah.
I'm no
Think
Jim
about that in
Abbott.
terms of Jim Abbott.
Lindsey Pease furious.
He'd be like, chop off my other one. I'll pitch a no-hitter with no hands, jerked.
Actually, that's a quote, direct quote from his post-game speech, I believe.
It was a taunt, really. He was just taunting people, daring them. Two more questions. This one's from young Matthew O from Verona. Have you ever hit a home run? He wrote. If so, what was your celebration? Exclamation mark, question mark. You ever hit a home run, Matt?
Yes, of course. Gym class. I was a home
Jim.
run hero in gym class.
What was your celebration?
You know, I don't remember, man. I don't think I celebrated because that would have been, you know, poor sportsmanship.
And why celebrate a thing that happens so regularly? You only celebrate if it's rare, right?
Thank you, Steele. And yeah, it was only gym class, but I was kind of the best one there, the best player.
Nice. How about you, Dave? Probably not.
Well, thanks, Steele. And the answer is probably no. I don't think I've ever hit a home run. So my home run celebration is still in the bag. One day it may happen.
I want you to imagine that you get a fly ball out of the infield. How would you celebrate that at least?
Just a vigorous hustle to first base. It'd be a single. It'd be my first one, so I'd be pretty excited.
That's nice. I have a home run story. I did hit a home run in Little League Baseball. I was on a tournament team, and my parents went out of town, and that meant that I was living with my coach for the weekend. And normally there'd be these weekend tournaments you play Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And because I was Mormon, I didn't play on Sundays. But my parents went out of town and they said, hey, you can choose for yourself, make the right decision. You know, they're like the gentle pressure so that you feel guilted into not playing on Sunday, right? And I was like, awesome. My parents are out of town. I am playing on Sunday. And so I played on the Sunday and I hit a grand slam. And it was my only grand slam of my career. And I was like, this is probably not the message my parents wanted to send to me. But the message for me was, play on Sunday. Good things happen.
It's the Lord's day after all. Yeah, wonderful things happen on Sundays.
He sanctified my swing, that's for sure.
So, did you ever tell your parents about that grand slam?
Yeah, I did. I did. I told them when they got back, and they said, well, I don't know what the response was, but I guess you made your decision. Satan has
That
power
baseball
over
in
the
the
earth.
outfield.
I don't know what they would have said. Here's a great question, and this is apropos because we have an MBA on the podcast this week. This is from Neil R. from Youngstown, Ohio. I've stopped paying attention to baseball because it now feels like I have to know all sorts of new statistics to understand the sport. I'm done. Statistics ruined it for me. What else have statistics ruined?
What haven't statistics ruined? Goodness. It's horrible, man. It's horrible. I'm glad. Who is this, Neil?
Yeah, from
Yeah, Neil,
Youngstown.
you're a man close to my heart. It seems like you can't turn around without someone coming up with some statistic of this percentage of that or that percentage of this or something here or something there, or trying to make sense out of something that really shouldn't be tried to make sense out of, using math and abstract science, and
Big data.
disgusts me.
And statistics have ruined the art of medicine. Now you can't just be an artist with medicine. You have to do what the statistics say. You can't just make stuff up as you go along anymore. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, everybody's worried about survival rates. Stupid statistics.
Yeah, they're tracking what the treatment you give, and they're going to be able to tell if it's good or not. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, who cares about infection? I had a lot of flair when I was using that scalpel.
Oh, and it also ruined statistics class. Statistics class was the worst class I've ever taken, and statistics was absolutely the cause of that being a terrible class.
And that's a high achievement because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you were a communications major.
Look, there are a lot of people out there that live their lives based on fact and statistics and reason, and I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't, I mean, you know, I know I've got all sorts of stuff that I know and things that would be better, and nope.
Yeah. Fact and statistics are going to tell you that you, if you want a hit song, you don't put flute in it every time. It's, that's what they're going to tell you. And it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
That's a perfect segue, because we have probably, forget these qualifiers. We have the greatest segment of Unchained Melodies ever unchained. We today are going to bring you a solid several minutes of pure Jethro Tull. For the first time ever, we have picked...
And keep listening. Please keep listening. It's flute, but it's good. You don't turn off the podcast just because he said Jethro Tull. We got flute.
Dave, you already lost him, man. Trust me. Like, that my experience is once you say Jethro Tull...
Click. Next. We're going to pick one artist, Jethro Tull, and do all six songs from that artist. I can't wait to start this off. I've been waiting for this for years. This is my favorite. It's hard to pick a favorite. This is a great Jethro Tull song I'm going to start us off with. It is Skating Away on the Thin Ice of a New Day.
Come on, Jethro, just start. Get the flute out already.
That's what makes it so good, Dave. You gotta wait like 40 seconds. He's like pouring water, he's humming, making tea.
This is high art.
Wow, it's still going?
Yes.
Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son, if your pants were undone, 'cause you were bred for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away.
The xylophone is what makes that song an instant classic.
And I love the gentle build at the start of the song of 40 seconds of Jethro pouring a cup of tea. It just makes you anticipate the song.
I thought he was taking a leak.
It could have been, yeah. It's probably when your pants are undone. I mean, that's just great lyrics, great delivery, great prelude. It's got it all.
Well, Steele, when this segment was first suggested, I just wanted to play one Tull song six times because there's one definitive greatest Tull song of all time. It's hands down. You don't need any other Tull if you've got this Tull. And it, of course, is Bungle in the Jungle.
Walking through forests of hungry apartments, scoff at the monkeys who live in their dark tents. Down by the wall,
poetry.
So good. I'm a tiger when I want love. I agree.
I'm a snake when we disagree. All right, Matt, what do you got for us? Lay some Tull on us.
Oh, you know, I, you know, still, Bore. You familiar with that one?
Yeah.
Sounds like
stand-up
a
album.
A deep cut.
Bourre, I think.
Do you want the song?
Yeah, man, it's beautiful. It's got a lot of flute. I think it's ripped off from a piece of Mozart or something, just to show the variety of these guys. But it's hard for me to choose just a couple of Jethro Tull songs.
Well, we're going to go with Bore. Here you go.
Imagine him not performing that song in the nude. I don't understand how he could wear pants performing that.
The audience would just tear him off him if he tried.
Come on, guys.
Okay.
I'm sorry. We're being disrespectful to Tull, and that's not...
Yeah, stop disrespecting the Tull.
You want one of the sweetest Jethro Tull songs? This is where he shows... Ian Anderson shows his kind of soft, sensitive side. This is a really lovely song called Life's Is a Long Song.
When you're falling awake and you take stock of the new day, and you hear your voice croak as you choke on what you need to say, well, don't you fret, don't you fear, I will give you good cheer. Life's a long song. Life's a long song. Life's a long song. If you wait, then you play, and I will fail.
I chose that one just to show you how much you can get out of one set of guitar chords, because those are exactly the same ones from Skating Away on the Thin Ice of a New Day. But when he puts new words to it, you just feel so different.
So, Steele, it's hard for me to choose another Tull song, because like I said, Bungle in the Jungle is my jam. That's just my jam. I want to hear it again, but there's other Tull I also appreciate. We talked about Thick as a Brick. Mm. They actually, I believe they did a radio edit to where they actually have a pretty terrific 3 or 4 minute chunk of the 30 minute long song. So I'd like to hear that.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel, but I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animals deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
That really is a great song.
That genuinely, I do like that song. It's really good.
I've got a little hotspot that I use to, as Dave says, get on the internets. And the title of my Wi-Fi is Bungle in the Jungle. And I take great delight in turning that thing on in public places and just knowing that that's popping up on people's Wi-Fi.
Nice. Way to spread the gospel of Tull. Well, Howard, this is your last chance. I mean, we've played 5 amazing Tull songs. You want to take us out on the 6th and last one? Something
you
want to ring into people's ears?
A little too upbeat around here, a little too much fun. I would love for us just to listen to the entire Aqualung album, but instead let's go to, the song is called My Sunday Feeling.
Oh.
It's on their debut album, This Was, in 1968. It's just one of the many greats that are on this album.
My Sunday Feeling's coming on. My Sunday feeling's coming up over me.
man, Howard's daughter just walked up to him. She must have been called by the toll. She just heard it, felt it, and came in.
Yeah.
Called by the toll. That's scary.
That's beautiful. He seems like he transitions really quick between flute and singing. He's ready to go.
Yeah, he can play the flute and sing at the same time, Dave.
Does he really?
Easily.
Man. Circular breathing, that's his secret.
Ian Anderson. He pretty cool guy, really.
Well, that was a classic. I think people will be talking about that for years. The time that we played six Tool songs back to back to back.
That's pretty crazy. I don't think that's ever been done before, like in the history of music.
All right, we're going to go to the top of the charts. I know it. Well, the time has come, everybody. We've got a little bit of book wisdom, and then we're going to have to leave you. Dave, what do you have for us this week?
So I don't know if this really goes along with anything we've spoken about today, but this book was sitting on my nightstand and I was reading it last night, and it's a powerful book. It's by Tim O'Brien. It's called The Things They Carried. Tim was a Vietnam veteran, and it's a novel that's kind of a collection of short stories that kind of flow together as a book, as a novel. It's really interesting. And my favorite part is probably the first short story that's actually called The Things They Carried. So I'm going to read a short segment of that. The things they carried were largely determined by necessity. Among the necessities or near necessities were P-38 can openers, pocket knives, heat tabs, wrist watches, dog tags, mosquito repellent, chewing gum, candy, cigarettes, salt tablets, packets of Kool-Aid, lighters, matches, sewing kits, military payment certificates, sea rations, and two or three canteens of water. Together, these items weighed between 15 and 20 pounds, depending on a man's habits or rate of metabolism. Henry Dobbins, who was a big man, carried extra rations. He was especially fond of canned peaches and heavy syrup over pound cake. Dave Jensen, who practiced field hygiene, carried a toothbrush, dental floss, and several hotel-sized bars of soap he'd stolen on R&R in Sydney, Australia. Ted Lavender, who was scared, carried tranquilizers until he was shot in the head outside the village of Than Ky in mid-April. By necessity, because it was SOP, they all carried steel helmets that weighed 5 pounds, including the liner and camouflage cover. They carried the standard fatigue jackets and trousers. Very few carried underwear. On their feet, they carried jungle boots, 2.1 pounds, and Dave Jensen carried 3 pairs of socks and a can of Dr. Scholl's foot powder as a precaution against trench foot. Until he was shot, Ted Lavender carried 6 or 7 ounces of premium dope, which was for him a necessity. Mitchell Sanders, the RTO, carried condoms. Norman Bowker carried a diary. Rat Kiley carried comic books. Kiowa, a devout Baptist, carried an illustrated New Testament that had been presented to him by his father, who taught Sunday school in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. As a hedge against bad times, however, Kiowa also carried his grandmother's distrust of the white man, his grandfather's old hunting hatchet. Nevertheless, necessity dictated, because the land was mined and booby-trapped, it was SOP for a man to carry a steel-centered, nylon-covered flak jacket, which weighed 6.7 pounds, but which on hot days seemed much heavier. Because you could die so quickly, each man carried at least one large compress bandage, usually in the helmet band for easy access. Because the nights were cold and because the monsoons were wet, each carried a green plastic poncho that could be used as a raincoat or ground sheet or makeshift tent. With its quilted liner, the poncho weighed almost 2 pounds, but it was worth every ounce. In April, for instance, when Ted Lavender was shot, they used his poncho to wrap him up, then carry him across the paddy, then to lift him into the chopper that took him away.
Beautiful, Dave. I'd really like to read that book.
Yeah, man.
It's just a great collection that really opens your eyes to, I guess, what these men went through in Vietnam. There's one passage that haunts me. I originally read this book more than a decade ago, where they become under enemy fire in a field, and they realize as this is happening that this is the field where everyone in the town defecates. So they're just in a field of shit, and they're getting shot at in this field. And it's just terrifying. And the men really went through those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, have a great rest of your day.
Yeah. Just to bring you all down. Maybe we should play some more Tall just to lighten the atmosphere again.
Yeah, what do you want to hear?
Aqualung. Let's go out on Aqualung. 7 Toll songs, 1 podcast, never been done.
This is more of an achievement of that than that. What's that cowboy guy you were talking about?
You know, Dave, did I ever tell you the time that Courtney, our friend Courtney Hull, took me down to all one of those practice rooms in the music place Whoa. There at BYU, and she played this song on the piano for me?
No.
Like, she learned it and played it on the piano, and I almost married her right there. I mean, it was like, it was everything she could do to have me not marry her. It was just the best. Like, seriously, that was like the highlight of my BYU experience.